I mean, I've got some select good ones. Like, they're like some are students' doodles that they'll have randomly on something. Some I can tell they're just having fun with it. But like, they're just like, well, I don't know anything about Macbeth, but he sounded like a bad motherfucker. And that's how this kid's thing starts. And the rest of it, then he just writes about him and his buddy skateboarding on the weekend. And I gave him points for creativity, but like, I mean, he failed the whole thing.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are my co-host, Richard Wally.
And from California, you are my co-host, Cassidy Robinson, or maybe Salt Lake City, somewhere in there. I don't know.
I've had a little bit of a trip. I took a trip and I came back. I am now still in California as of this podcast. We'll see you in 2 to 3 weeks. But today we have a guest. Friend of the show, Patrick, from Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. Also, one of the only people who sends us email. He's almost like our third co-host as it is.
That's true.
Well, thank you very much. I've had both of you gentlemen on both shows.
Yes.
With Dad and I'm with Dennis.
This has been a long time coming to get you on our show. I think people who do listen to the show regularly, who maybe don't already know you, are probably, who's this Patrick guy they're always talking about?
Oh, I know. Well, I smile every time on the run when I get a reference, like a Patrick reference. I take it off in my head.
No, yeah. I make them every. I try to make them every week, just for
you,
buddy.
Do. Yeah, I appreciate it greatly. And if Dad ever listened to a single podcast, he'd probably appreciate it too in some way. So don't feel bad.
Well, if you're ever on a long car trip and you want to show him what a podcast is, you can just plug us in.
Cassie, I've tried. Trust me, I've tried this before. And he just gets really upset, and he just says we have to turn on like local news for the longest time so I can hear the same 20-minute cycle of news because that's more important than learning anything new, I guess.
So I wanted to have you on specifically because, you know, you do Make Dad Read Comics, and you – that's how I got to know you primarily is I saw on Reddit when I went to the daily feed to post my episode for the week, and I almost never do this, so this is super rare. But I saw the title underneath me or above me, Make Dad Read Comics, and – I always say this is why you need a really good name for your show. I said, that sounds like something I want to listen to. So I just clicked on it and I sampled like 4 or 5 episodes and it was exactly what it says on the tin.
That was the goal. Yeah, the show is exactly what the title says. I make my 60, well, when we started, he was 60, 65, he's 67 now. Mm-hmm. My 67-year-old father who, when we began, thought that comic books were, as he said, literature for the illiterate. Like, he thought that they would give it to people like mental institutions to keep them at bay. My dad has no pop culture knowledge whatsoever, so everything is brand new. He's the best person in the world to introduce, better than like an 11-year-old kid who's never – because they've seen Lego Batman and things like that. My dad has no idea. Mm-hmm. And I just try to each week teach my dad a different aspect of comics by giving him a different comic book.
Right, and get his uninitiated response.
Right, and sometimes point out how stupid things are that I think are genius, and I realize, oh, that is pretty stupid.
Right, and stuff like, you know, that I think is really interesting about the show is, like, tropes that we're all very, very familiar with growing up in kind of geek culture or whatever, having read comic books. There's stuff that actually need to be explained to someone who has no idea. Like, all this stuff in between the lines or in between the panels, you have to, okay, so the reason he's doing that is because back in 1980 whatever, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's probably the educating of my dad, hopefully educating anyone listening of anything in the world of comics, like how to make them, how they're designed, you know, writers, artists, all that kind of things. But yeah, the other thing too with my dad is I have no fallback. There's no B and say, well, it's like this. I can't say this is like, you know, Doctor Who or even like Starsky and Hutch stuff of his era that he would pick up because he didn't watch television. So I have to make like the most broadband simple, easy references to things. And it just makes me a little stronger in my explanations to them.
Right, right. And actually, it kind of works as a show concept because as you're explaining everything to your dad, you're explaining everything to the audience who may not be as well-versed also. So it makes it more inclusive of a show, which is probably why, I mean, I don't have the numbers, but I would say as far as comic book-related podcasts go, you probably have more listeners who aren't normally comic book fans than the average comic book listener.
Yeah, I'm so horrible with my numbers. I don't know. Like, they fluctuate all the time. And there's so many cross platforms. But the way my barometer is, we get lots of emails from people all the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they'll say, like, I'm not really into comic books either. And I'll say, well, that's half the show. Like, my dad's the voice. He's not. My dad doesn't enjoy comic books very much either. Like, mm-hmm. 1 out of 10 he might like. The rest are, he'll forget them by the next week. Because I'll say, hey, do you remember who Daredevil is? Never heard of the man. You know, we've read like 6 Daredevil issues in the past year, but because it's not as immediate sensory short term memory, yeah. Never heard of the man.
It didn't stay in the lockbox of memory.
No, between... as he said, that would be yeah, right. It was never cemented. He calls it frivolous information.
Right, and
I mean, he's not wrong.
No, he's not. That's what he points out, Richard. He points out that I'm typically wrong to put so much investment, time, and love into this thing.
Well, I remember one time I was on Netflix, and I went to go look to all of the movies I had star rated. Because mm-hmm. most of the time, not all the time, probably less now than I used to, but I used to like just give a star rating for everything without actually writing anything. And I went back and just for curiosity's sake, just looked back to everything I'd watched. And there were entire movies I was like, I don't remember seeing that. I mean, I kind of remember the cover now and like the title, but I could not tell you a single thing about what happens in that movie. That's how little impact it had on me, mm-hmm. which is really scary because it like really questions my memory. But
well, you're one human being. You can only consume so much information and media. It all kind of blends together into one giant, you know, Joseph Campbell monomyth in your head, I guess.
Right.
Also, I mean, human beings, we also always want to talk about our memory as being some infallible thing, but it's really actually very normal for you to have those kind of blank spots. Your brain just kind of fills them in to make you feel, you know, special and unique and like you have one single life story, but you don't. So hold dear to that.
Thanks, Richard.
That warm blanket. Just wrap yourself in that.
So yeah, you know, you do a comic book show and I said I wanted to have you on as soon as we start getting into the comic book movies, which is why I had you on to discuss My Big Fat Greek Wedding 2.
Oh, good. That's what I watched. I got my own Windex next to me so I can spray it whenever we make a funny point.
Mm-hmm. Good.
That's all I know from that film. It has something to do with Windex.
You know more than we do. I haven't actually seen that. All I've seen is this horrible romantic comedy that starred her that my in-laws made me watch, and I'm still bitter and angry about it. So
I hate Valentine's Day. I remember when I worked at the video store, we used to rent that out. We're actually going to be discussing Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice. And at the end of the show, in our Netflix homework, we're going to discuss Shelter, which you assigned to us, Patrick.
Yeah.
And next week, I promise, we'll get to The Conformist.
Yeah.
Yes. But
I didn't know it was a Bertolucci, by the way.
Right, right. But
did you know?
Yes, I did, because I mentioned it on the show.
No. Well, I didn't. Like I said, I don't listen to you.
I know.
You remember that whole memory thing that I was talking about? Yeah, refer back to that.
Also spacing out, yeah. But before we get into that, Patrick, ding, ding.
Oh, no.
I have a bell ringer for you.
Okay, do you want to explain the origin of bell ringer? I have another podcast, Almost Educational. This is where the bell ringer comes from, I take it, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't come up with it independently. Okay. Yeah, so you and your friend, you're both teachers in the education system, and you talk about, you know, you kind of workshop different sort of discussions based upon different topics that may or may not be topical or alternative history or what have you.
They're all the topics that are, well, as the show says, almost educational, but would never fit in our curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
They're like thought experiments or philosophical arguments or tangents that we're just not allowed to take. And so they're the things we used to commute together to work. And I'd say, wouldn't it be awesome if we could just talk about this today? And then we would talk about it and we'd come to class and end up talking about, you know, dry facts and structuring sentences and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
These are things we'd like to talk about.
but
we also have a quiz that warms up like you have a bell ringer to warm up the students.
Right. And it's one of my favorite parts of the show because it reminds me a lot of the pub quizzes I go to, the type of questions mm-hmm. they answer there.
A lot of them were stolen directly from those, so that makes perfect sense.
Oh, good. Well, maybe I'll have some answers in my back pocket when I actually go back to one of those. But here's the one I made up today. It's called Real Movie or Made Up. I'm going to give you the synopsis to a film, and you have to tell me, is this a real movie or is this something I made up?
Okay.
And I've showed Richard already, so he knows. Okay, the first one. An aged goth rocker, not unlike Robert Smith, grapples with his irrelevance in pop culture and the history of his past fans committing suicide. To find absolution, he travels westward through America to hunt down and kill a former Nazi responsible for the deaths of his elders.
Oh my god, I'd love to see that if it was. I'm going to say real movie.
You are correct. This is a real movie. It's called This Must Be the Place. It came out in 2011 with Sean Penn starring as a Robert Smith lookalike. Totally bizarre.
I'm writing that one down.
We did it as Netflix somewhere a long time ago.
Okay.
Here's another one. A man unknowingly has the member of a serial rapist attached during a routine penis replacement surgery. Upon recovery, he begins to fall prey to his own desire for carnal violence.
It sounds very trauma-like, but I know there was one where the guy had the hair replacement that's like Tales from the Dark Side and turned into a serial killer, and there was a vagina movie. But I don't know if it involved transplants. I'm going to say false on that one.
It is real.
Oh my
god. The movie is called The Amazing Transplant. It came out in 1970. It was a exploitation roughie, directed by Doris Wishman, who was one of the only female exploitationeers back then. All right. So you're one.
I tried real hard.
I did too. I that's why I was smiling the whole time and described the vagina transplant.
We watched that in our cult movie class. It was great. Okay, here's another one. A Civil War era blacksmith becomes a hero when he saves the lives of a neighboring African American family from an outlaw gang of disgruntled ex-soldiers. He fights the group in a suit of armor he builds himself.
False.
You're correct. I made that up. But I would totally watch the shit out of that.
Trademark that.
Okay. A Parisian gypsy becomes obsessed with an American porn star, convinced that they share a divine connection. He travels across seas to meet her at the world-famous adult expo that's held annually in Las Vegas.
True.
False. I made that up.
That's a good one. Trademark that one, too. Yeah, that bad boy.
I actually changed it from Eastern European to Parisian because I realized that's just Borat. I just said Borat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that movie has been.
Yeah, kind of, sort of has. Okay, last one. In the dystopian future of 1994, a folk singing duo are tempted by an evil record executive selling their souls into the decadent world of the mainstream music industry. After escaping his nefarious scheme to control society through microchips and disco music, they are raptured into heaven by God himself, who arrives in a gilded Rolls Royce.
Ooh, that sounds a little bit like Six String Samurai, but then you got real crazy with it. I'm going to say true, though.
It is true. This is another movie we reviewed in the Netflix homework. It's called The Apple. It came out in 1980, and it is hilariously awful.
Oh, it has to be. It's
pretty crazy.
It's pretty good. All right.
I got it from Edgar Wright.
Yes.
Oh, there
you told
go.
Me yeah, to watch sense. It.
I know a lot of. They show it around L.A. a lot. There's a certain kind of fan base for that movie. Disco cocaine musicals of the 70s and 80s. So
fun.
You did pretty well. I think you got three out of five. Three.
Oh, four out of three. I thought I went 3 for 5.
You got This Must Be the Place right.
Right.
You got The Amazing Transplant wrong.
Correct.
You got the Civil War one right.
Right.
Oh, you're right. It was 3 out of, because you got both of my made up ones wrong.
That's okay. Casty, math is also our huge bane on the show. Like, shifting of not knowing, like, if it's 35 or 40, it's our base number all the time. So I understand.
Right. I should have been marking it or something as it went along. But you did very well. And now we're warmed up. Okay. So we'll get into the movie news. And I'll start out with this one because I guess it got a little bit of traction on our Facebook page, which is to say we got a comment on it. If you're not following us on Facebook, you should. Facebook.com/JabberPodcast, I think. Okay, Killer Clowns from Outer Space possibly being resurrected for TV. Did you ever see Killer Clowns from Outer Space, Patrick?
Yeah, I remember there was cotton candy involved, and it turns children into cocoons, and they, or some way they could eat the children.
Yes,
that's as far as I remember. It was one of those, like, in the Detroit area, a lot of times they would have, I'm sure they did it everywhere in the country, but like those local stations, like WGN here, or as in Chicago, but they would play like Saturday matinee movies, and that was always on.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Always on.
I think that's original. Well, I think we actually had it, for whatever reason, we had it recorded on an old VHS tape, like over 150 other things, so it played like garbage. But I think that's how I originally saw it.
I rented that sucker.
Oh, I imagine. Well, Richard, you're a horror buff. Could you see that being turned into a television show? Anyway, how would you workshop that?
I mean, yeah. The thing about TV is just, I guess, expanding it. I guess there could be like a weird mythology to go with the clowns. And, you know, when you get into some of those Netflix originals, they're mining really crazy, weird stuff. I mean, you've got, or even like FX, they did Wilfred from Australia about a talking dog. What was the other weird thing on Netflix, though? Danger 5, that's what it was called, where they fight a time traveling Hitler. So I could see it being one. I don't know what they would do. It'd have to be with a horror comedy. I'm not completely convinced with this kind of crossover into horror on TV, even though some of it's been pretty good.
Yeah. So. I because it's hard to sustain suspense in a horror kind of way when you're following characters, and that's the only way you can really tell a story. Or a long running story like a television show is to have a good entry point with a character, but you know they can never be in that much danger because if they die, the show's over.
Yeah, that's why I always thought anthologies work the best, like Tales from the Dark Side or Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah,
where it's just those one and done stories that are half hour, and you never have, as you said, you don't have to have false peril for any of your characters, and then ends up. I mean, look at The Walking Dead. Whenever they kill a character off in that show, you know, the fan base goes berserk and nuts, and they have to issue bizarre apologies for killing off fictional characters. I mean, that's what would happen with any kind of horror film.
That also happened often in the comic, like way before the TV series ever happened.
Yeah, that's true.
Or you could also claim Game of Thrones for that as well.
True.
So. Yeah, definitely. It's a weird IP to try and do something with, but it's probably a cheaper one. And with the success of like American Horror Story with like their carnival season and that kind of stuff, I can see there being some sort of market for something like this. It's really going to come down to getting somebody who understands the tone, which is campy as hell and really kind of like if like a Rob Zombie type, but not exactly him, were to do something with this, it could maybe work.
Well, I think there has to be a sense of humor to it, too. Yeah. I don't think it could just... Because Rob Zombie is coming out with 31, which is his Killer Clowns in a Maze. Mm. It's like that Fangoria movie we watched.
Oh, yeah. What was that called? Slashers?
I don't know. Slashers, yeah. That was the name.
It was like Hunger Games made on a $2,000 budget. Yeah. Mm. All right, Richard, what was your first story?
My first and probably only story is going to be the Guillermo del Toro. The new film that he's kind of adapting and trying to get going is a 1960s Cold War era supernatural thriller. So far, the only person that they got mostly for sure is Octavia Spencer. And they're also trying to get Michael Stuhlbarg, which he's had all these like little blip parts, but he's always great in. The last thing I think I saw him in was Steve Jobs.
Yeah, he was really, really
but he
good
was great in.
Yeah, and I liked him obviously a lot in the Coen Brothers, A Serious Man, which he was sort of he was the main star of. And I think most people are probably familiar with him through Boardwalk Empire.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe Men in Black 3. He was the weird alien thing that kept popping up and talking to Will Smith randomly.
Do you have an opinion about this, Patrick?
The premise alone I'm a sucker for anything Cold War, and if you throw sci-fi or horror into that, or super, you said supernatural, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm all aboard. It's just, again, Del Toro just has, so I don't know what's going on, but after The Wolfman, things have just spiraled for him in terms of anything he puts out. Well, I take that back, because Sicario.
I think you're thinking of the wrong Del Toro. Right.
Yeah, you're thinking of Benicio Del Toro. Del Toro.
Oh, see, your Spanish was too good for me. I forgot the guy who did Seawall. Then definitely no, because Pacific Rim was a film that turned me completely off from him. Pacific Rim really turned me off from it. Like, I liked Pan's Labyrinth. Mm-hmm. I liked Hellboy 2. Pacific Rim was just so just ugly. It was just such an ugly film to me. And it was just ugly. I just don't want to see anything from him for a long time. I think he'd be better on television. Like we talked about television. If that was adapted for TV, I could see him working. But anything on the big screen, I'm pretty gun shy for him.
Mm. Well, he was the executive producer of The Strain, right?
Yeah, but I think
that's from his own book, though, too.
Exactly. So
TV works weird because he's the executive producer, but that means he's the showrunner, basically.
Right. I thought Carlton Cruise, or that's how you say his name, right? The guy, he runs like every show in the world in America now.
Yeah.
From Lost, was the guy who really probably does the heavy lifting there of adapting the material, which is a good book series. I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But, again, it's already been laid as a book series. I don't know. Now I figured out my right Del Toro, I'm a little worried.
Well, I'm not as as worried as you are. But I will say, it's been a long time since I've loved a Del Toro movie. I liked Pacific Rim enough for big, dumb fun. Mm. I didn't really care for Crimson Peak, which we reviewed on the show.
Yeah, I remember that.
And so I'm waiting for him to make a great film again. And it may be dealing in, the Cold War and having kind of a political backdrop or something like that might bring a little bit more narrative heft. Mm. But, yeah, I don't know.
I'm a sucker for his stuff. I'll go watch it. It doesn't really matter. I'll say that his last couple of films haven't been in the ballpark as good as Pan's Labyrinth or The Devil's Backbone. However, or I'll even say the Hellboy movies. I thought that I really enjoyed those still.
Yeah, I do.
I still don't think, I don't know, he still to me hasn't made it all an all out failure of a film. So I will go and see it and be like, okay, I'll give you the opportunity. But again, I kind of liked Crimson Peak though too. I liked Crimson Peak. Mm-hmm. It didn't blow me away, but I liked Crimson Peak and I liked Pacific Rim. It was big, dumb fun where big robots fuck big monsters. And that was about it.
Yeah, I don't want to go on that, but I just really struggled with that movie. And I thought it was going to be more of Pan's Labyrinth with some kind of political back. I thought it was going to be about geopolitics. Well, man, I was going way too in-depth when I went into it. I was like, what is this? This is a giant toy commercial. What is this? It's not what I expected. Mm-hmm. And at that point, too, I was very burned out with Large Spectacle. Godzilla really pissed me off as well. And I think I was just the following year, so it might have... Again, like we're talking about memory, those might have cemented into the same film for me at some point where I just hated both of them.
Yeah, that's another thing I like to harp on is biases and how that affects your film watching.
Well, I think it's a fair criticism. I ended up liking it more than not liking it, but I don't blame anyone who didn't find a lot in it, but we'll see.
Well,
we'll see,
there's not a lot to it. It's popcorn.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You throw in the popcorn and it's gone.
True.
Okay, so Robert De Niro. This is a little interesting. I'm really interested to hear what everyone has to say about it. Robert De Niro is, heading the jury for the Tribeca Film Festival. And he had to yank an anti-vax movie called Vaxxed from his programming because the science community and a bunch of people, protesters and stuff, who heard that they were going to be showing this movie pretty much flooded the Tribeca Film Festival with all of this data and all of this stuff, all this outrage. And so they felt pressured to force Robert De Niro to take it off. He said he had it included because it deals with his own personal history dealing with autism. But, what do we think of the idea, before we even get into the politics of the anti-vax movement, what do we think of the idea that, public outrage can pull certain kinds of documentaries from film festivals? Because I am not an anti-vaxxer. I'm pro-science when it comes to this. But I think that this is sort of a dangerous precedent.
This is a very almost educational topic.
I know.
I think I would... For me, it's hard to separate myself. I'm also, like, vaccinating everyone all the time for everything. I could see the direct result of this movement for the past 20 years as a teacher. We have, you know, bizarre illnesses that there was a school closed down recently in our district for, like, whooping cough. And, like, that was something that was supposed to be gone for the longest time. And when we had people from the state health department come out and say, well, herd mentality is probably lost in elementary school because you have a large majority of kids here. We saw your records that weren't vaccinated. So I saw the direct result of it, and it was really scary times. I mean, it was people in hazmat suits, and, you know, not for, like, bed bugs or something. It was for, you know, it is a disease that could either kill or maim a bunch of students.
Mm-hmm.
But I see what you're saying, that it sets precedent that then whenever anyone has enough outcry and they can say we have science or we have God or we have whatever in our corner to back us up, then we can pull something. But again, it's a film festival. He can still, it's not no one censoring his freedom of speech.
Right.
In any way, he can show it anywhere he wants to show it. He has the means, the money to do so. I just worry that if this was something else where there was, I think if you have scientists saying so instead of a political action committee that's murky and we don't really know who they're supported by, but if you have someone in, say, the CDC or somewhere else come out and saying, no, this is bad, this is dangerous, I say it's the right move. And it's not the government censoring it, so I have no issue, but take it off.
What about
my first reaction was good, but then, like, kind of going over it, my next thought was like, well, then there's like about a billion, like, propaganda-esque, like, documentaries that come out every year that kind of play fast and loose with the facts. So to me, it's like, okay, so why is this one so special and important? It's kind of like when like a while back, that guy that I forgot his name, but basically he made an AIDS pill really, really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It was great that people kind of combined and, like, got him to, like, drop down the prices and call him a douchebag all over the internet. So he looked bad. That was great.
Right.
But then it still doesn't, there's still, like, a thousand other of those dudes out there. And you only won that battle against that one dude. So to me, that's just kind of like, okay, that's one.
No, yeah, I know. But I think that it's something that directly affects the health of people.
Right.
And it's information that would lead to deaths or, you know, small level epidemics in certain
communities. I agree, but I guess as the propaganda goes, it's already out there. You're not,
true,
I mean,
true.
I don't think, I mean, I guess it might convince a few more people if we're talking about the people who are on, like, sitting on the fence and, like, should I be a vaccinator or shouldn't I? But it's already out there. I don't think you're going to be, like, informing anybody at Tribeca that there's anti-vaxxers in the world either.
Not really true.
So to me, it's a little like, whatever.
Yeah.
So I kind of just at the end kind of just go, okay, that's weird.
It's I mean, the film itself, this case study in particular, I don't think holds as much weight on this particular topic. But I don't like the idea that people submit documentaries to different film festivals, which are not necessarily political organizations at all. They're just film festivals for people to show whatever. I don't like the idea that an unpopular topic can be pulled if there's enough people telling them to. But that's probably not the first time it's ever happened. And I'm sure there were plenty of times when unpopular topics on the right side of history were pulled for outrage on the other side.
Right. No, it completely is like a bad precedent, but you're probably right in everything you're saying. It's not, this isn't the first time. This is just the first time that we've either noticed or, like, picked up on it in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's enough name recognition with Robert De Niro that it falls to the front of the docket of news stories coming out of things getting pulled. And, like, as you said, I'm sure there's plenty of others in the recent history, but without Robert De Niro maybe attached to it.
Right. Well, that's our movie news. That's all we have time for today. We did post other stories, and if you want to see those, like I said, follow us on facebook.com/jabberpodcast, and you can comment and leave your opinions on whatever we posted here. But let's get into our main review, the big kahuna. The reason I had you on, Patrick, and that is for Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. Who wants to try and sum this movie up?
I think it's pretty easy.
I'll let you, you do it then. Yes, go for it.
Okay. There's a lot of ins and outs, but basically Lex Luthor has this evil scheme and he gets Batman to, or he gets Superman to fight Batman and pits them against each other in a battle royale that kind of finishes in the end. It's actually really very typical. A lot of it's actually kind of straight out of the comics. It does so in a very quick manner. And there is a lot of ins and outs and like little like terrorist plots and stuff, I think, that can pull you aside. Mm-hmm. But it's basically Lex Luthor has a scheme and Superman and Batman end up fighting.
Yeah.
I mean, the point where I really got there was the point where it comes to Coalition. I'm like, oh, so it's not just like these two people hate each other. It really is a scheme by evil Lex Luthor. Okay, gotcha. And then, which is fine. It's just, this movie is kind of, for me, this was a very similar viewing experience to Man of Steel.
Okay.
Which I guess to kind of prep anybody else listening, Man of Steel was just eh to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not a hater of it. I'm not a lover of it. I just watched it and it happened. And I said, oh, Superman sure did kill a lot of people. Oh, that's interesting. This film goes to odd lengths to try to justify that. What's funny as a comic book fan is I think that actually if a comic book like was more, if it was less about art and the cartoony styles of it and things like that, I don't think that you'd get pulled into the, I don't think you'd get pulled into the how many people are dying as much. Because also, this movie automatically made me think Batman has definitely killed a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because how many times did he punch the wrong junkie in the throat and like he just had a heart attack and died? And you just don't see that in the comics. So
right.
I think movies kind of put you in a weirder place. So that being said, Batman versus Superman, it was a comic movie. It was a Zack Snyder movie. It happened really quickly. And it was okay.
All right, Patrick, I'll let you go. What did you think?
All right, well, I have to approach it in three ways. The first way is, whenever I look at these things, I realize that, first of all, it's a film, and it's adapting material that I know really well, and that I've like become obsessed with since a youth, since 8 years old. I mean, to the point where like I know an unhealthy amount of backstory, including writers and artists on things and how they are adapted. For me, as a film, I'm sure I'm in a chorus of people saying I don't enjoy Zack Snyder films. I like, what was it? It was Dawn of the Dead remake. I liked that for its novelty.
Mm-hmm.
I got caught up in 300, but the first thing is he's the wrong person for these big spectacle films. As a film and adapting, I'll say it this way: the problem is Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers is not the mouse, and it's not Marvel before that. They are a fourth-tier movie company now at this point who have the CW television series, which draws directly from Greg Berlanti and Kreisberg and a bunch of other guys who all have a toe, and Jeff Johns, in the writing of comic books. They understand how this goes.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, growing up all the time, that Marvel characters were supposed to be grim and gritty, and everyone had consequences. People died. They had feet of clay. DC characters were these mythic characters that were archetypes, and they were supposed to be archetypes of things, and everyone in the DC universe loves their superheroes. And you could see that translated on your television screens with Supergirl, The Flash, and Green Arrow, and everyone loves those just for that reason. They smile and they have fun being superheroes. That's part of the thing. It's a childlike
I would digress with Arrow, but I'm going to leave it there because we don't need to go into that
right.
tirade.
Well, my thing, he's the doppelganger for Batman. But the thing is that I don't think Scott Snyder understands this. I think he likes comic books. I just don't think he likes that idea of comic books. And His Batman is awesome. Like, that was the best. Ben Affleck did a great job for me as Batman. The way that his Batman was, even branding people, and for me, Jim Aparo / Dennis O'Neill into Frank Miller Batman, there was always collateral damage that Batman may have punched a guy so hard his trachea went into his throat and he died 48 hours later in the surgeon's table, but that was the surgeon's fault in Batman's mind. It wasn't his.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't directly cause the death. He got all of that right. Batman should be scary, and Batman should be creepy, and Batman should be angry and simmering and not be able to control himself.
Agreed. He's a crazy-ass vigilante.
Yes. Superman should be Superman shouldn't have been this film. It should have been Batman and Wonder Woman to me. Like, Henry Cavill is doing his best job to be Christopher Reeves. He looks like Christopher Reeves. I'm a straight man, but there's points when he's filling out that S symbol. I'm like, oh my God, he looks so good. Like, he looks awesome as Superman. As I got older, when I was a kid, I know this is becoming rambling. I loved Batman because, as you said, Richard, he was a mean vigilante. And when you're going through puberty, you want to be a mean vigilante. But as I get older, in my 30s now, and I see that there's a lot of mean vigilantes and mean people in the world, in a fantasy world, I sure would like to escape in a world where Superman smiles and he's a farm boy who isn't always sees things as a glass perpetually full, not half full, always full, and he's always disappointed in humanity. He doesn't smile a single bit in this. People should love Superman. Everyone hates Superman in this. I'm just like, what's going on? Like, none of that made sense to me in the film. Mm-hmm. And then it was snapped to, like, I have a really good Batman movie going on, and at the end of the final third, I have a really good Wonder Woman introduction. And some other stuff thrown in, Zack Snyder style, done fast cuts and weird stuff. There's just, and I think it's a symptom of Zack Snyder being a poor director in terms of how to shoot a big spectacle, and Warner Brothers having no idea what to do with their properties and just having no idea how to market this. And part of the problem is there's been lots of versions of Batman they can emulate. There's been no version of Superman for the longest time. They have no idea how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a mess on screen. I liked 70% of the mess. And then the other 30%, I just rolled my eyes and said, oh, but there was nothing I could do. And it's just what it is. And it's a complete mess. I know that was a rambling, but the movie was a rambling mess. So I don't know how to best sum it up.
Okay. I think we're going to get all three spectrums on this. I thought this movie was nearly unwatchable. I got about 20 minutes in, and I had this sinking feeling in my stomach. It's like, oh, I know what this movie wants to be, and I don't want to be here. But besides the, okay, yes, there's fanboy issues. I will allow for that. I don't think anything about how these characters are portrayed on screen, as far as what I've known from them, from years and years of the media I've consumed involving them, resembles at all what their characters are.
Can I interject for 1 second?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I hear what you're saying, but the problem is these characters have existed in perpetuity of American media, essentially, since 1937.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many hands on this in terms of not just writing the comic books, but adapting it. Dwayne McDuffie adapted it to the Justice League animated series that most people would know from any age, because it exists in perpetuity on Netflix where kids can watch it.
Yeah.
There's a million versions of Batman.
There are.
And this is my version of Batman. I think this is like Batman of 1984 to 1992 to a T. Like in the comic books, Batman. He's not the Batman of the animated series. Right. He's not the Batman that we've seen in Christian Bale, but he's my Batman. So that hit it perfectly for me.
Okay. Yeah, very much inspired by the Frank Miller stuff.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the Dark Knight Returns and a lot of the visuals from this movie.
I would say Justice League, also Batman.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah.
That is a version of that character, and it definitely was the version that was in this film, I would say.
Okay, well, let's talk about the bigger problems then, which is I couldn't get into either of these characters, not only because I didn't recognize them as the characters they're supposed to be portraying, but because the film doesn't give either of these actors anything to do. There's so much going on in this movie. There's so many objectives to the movie. For one, it has to apologize for and deal with the narrative issues of the last third of Man of Steel, which a lot of people felt weird about. So they use that as a jumping off point for why Batman and Superman are pitted against each other, which is fine.
Yeah, it's not a horrible idea.
No,
I actually like that part. The opening scene with the perspective switch of Bruce Wayne scene, I thought that was clever.
Oh, see, I had a question. I was like, okay, so this billionaire comes and he gets in a Jeep instead of bringing his fucking bat. See, there's a lot of logical inconsistencies. And right from the get-go, that's where I turned off my brain. But, I'll admit, the reason I was like okay with this film, because you said all three spectrums. I didn't love this film, Cassidy. I said it was
more positive than I think Patrick or I are going to be.
That is true.
I mean, okay, so it has to deal with that stuff, and it has to sort it on its own, be a Man of Steel sequel, sort of. It also has to reintroduce Batman and reintroduce this version of Batman, which people are still so fresh with the Christopher Nolan take, which is kind of iconic at this point, that it has to really kind of, shake the Etch-A-Sketch on that version and come up with something new and integrate it into the Man of Steel Superman, which was sort of based on Christopher Nolan's aesthetic. So there's that going on. And then on top of it, it has to introduce and set up this world, the cinematic universe they want to build with the Justice League. And there's a lot of winking towards the camera and a lot of setting things up and a lot of plot threads that it can only go so far before they have to completely abandon it because they have to later plug into other sequels. And then lastly, the movie has to develop its own plot for why these two are fighting in the first place, which I understand on the base level that, you know, Richard laid it out. Yes, there's an evil Lex Luthor who's weirdly played by Jesse Eisenberg, is setting all of this up in some nefarious plot. I could not tell you exactly every detail of what that nefarious plot is. It literally makes no sense. Much of this movie makes no sense.
Here's the problem. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The only reason the characters seem to be behaving in the ways that they're behaving as the movie goes is so that other scenes can happen. I had no idea what the characters' motivations were. I had no idea why Lois Lane was ever in it. Like she just randomly shows up in scenes. I decided she must be like Superman's paging device, because if Batman has a bat signal, then the only way you can really get Superman to show up is to throw Lois Lane off a building. And then I had no idea who the center of consciousness ever is in the movie. The movie is constantly shifting between these five different objectives. And the way I described it in my review, which I've written but I haven't posted yet, is it plays like an extended recap of a season of television that I've never watched.
No, you're not wrong. This movie leans a lot on... by the way, none of your criticisms are wrong.
No, they're not.
The only one I would pick apart a little bit, maybe, is the Lex Luthor thing. I think it was fine. Basically, he was using the government. He was plotting this little thing with the government that he was like saying, "Oh, look what bad thing Superman is doing over here." And when he was actually doing it, that's all the plot was. It wasn't that complicated.
That was madcap comic book plot right there. If you look at it too hard, it falls apart. It's Jenga. You can't touch it too much.
Agreed. But your other criticisms are completely right. But this is the thing, is I knew going in this was a Zack Snyder movie. The other thing that you're talking about, this all leans on that you know enough about these characters.
Yeah.
Everything about this film, it does not stand on its own whatsoever. So for like a comic book guy, I could see liking the Batman. I kind of like the Batman. I was like, oh yeah, they made an allusion to Jason Todd. Oh, they made an allusion to this character. Oh, they made an allusion to that character. I was fine with that. With the Batman, with Ben Affleck's portrayal, I actually was fine with all of that. I was just like, how is this a Superman film? Like almost the whole time.
Yeah, well, and you're so right. I think the main problem here is it's not a strong film. I mean, if these characters weren't superheroic characters, it would still be a poorly done. If it was Harry Potter and Warner Brothers was relaunching Harry Potter, the problem is, again, they're behind the eight ball. And as you said, Cassidy, they're trying to set up a universe in one big bloated movie where you have no gravitas with any of these characters because they're all disparate and being thrown together. It's a mad scramble to make you care about any of them. Again, all you have to do to make people care about Superman is just show them rescuing more people. That's the best part of Superman, rescuing people. But they have no grasp on how they want to do this.
Well, also, and the scene where the big... Sorry, just to make a little interjection to support your point. There's this little... the big scene, their big showdown. Like, all the time I was like, why doesn't Superman just say, wait, stop, like, 20 more times because he can.
Right.
Instead, he's like, I'm going to fight fucking Batman.
See, that's more what I'm talking about with, like, I don't understand the characters' motivations and they don't behave like the characters I've known and loved. One of the things I like about Batman, besides the fact that he's just a cool vigilante who dresses like a bat and, you know, sort of a ninja or whatever, like, what I like about Batman is that he's the world's greatest detective. He's really, really smart. There's nothing in this movie that would lead you to believe that he's very smart.
Because it would have to be a 3-hour movie. It would have been even longer. Because if you put the show notes, those notes in front of Zack Snyder, if you were a script doctor, he would have been like, you're right. We have to add another 15 minutes to this, where we would have had him and Alfred analyzing more stuff. Oh, I forgot. There's so much stuff in here. Like, there's stuff that makes no sense. I forgot about the dream sequence for the Flash. And people wouldn't know that was the Flash. Where Batman
If you're into the comics, though, which I know you are too.
Oh, I loved it.
It's the Flashpoint thing.
Oh, my God.
But at the same time, you don't know what the fuck it is if you're not a sort of semi-comic book fan, like a big comic book fan.
Yeah, I was totally in the dark on that whole scene. I had so given up on the movie by that point, so I was really just kind of watching it with my head, like, laying flat in my palms.
Oh, I knew, like, 15 minutes in what your reaction would be. So I'm pleased with myself. But at the same time, I'm just like, yeah, I can see how you feel about that, Cassidy.
People were flying down. They look like locust people. And then
that was apocalypse. That was all amazing. But again, for you, for me, I was like, oh, they're really doing this. But for everyone else in the theater, I could see, like, my girlfriend had checked out after the first 5 minutes because she knows none of this. Right. And I usually lean over and explain things as it goes. And I just leaned over. I was like, I'll give you a recap in the car on the way home. Like, there's no way I was going to explain any of this when it happened. I just had a permagrin at moments. There were so many notes in here that were right. I'm sure people think it's saccharine and stupid. The part where they have the connection between both of their mothers are named Martha. Oh, man. Like, it got dusty in that theater. Like, I teared up because, like, that's one of the great connections. That they called each other a little bit, like, they would call each other Clark and Bruce. They never referred to each other as Superman, Batman. Again, all that hit all the right spots. But those were, like, small moments that gave me a nerd endorphin high that made me forget at the time everything else that was going on. And then when I left, I just said, why wasn't more of that and less of Superman brooding? Just Superman smiles, just brooding all the time, and quick cuts between everything and the discovery of Aquaman through YouTube videos and everything else. It was so confusing and nothing was explained. And I'm going to pronounce her name totally wrong. Gal Gadot, is that how you say her name?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
As Wonder Woman is completely wasted. She's the only one that smiles, and she smiles at the very end when she's fighting the rock monster from Lord of the Rings Doomsday thrown in there at the end.
Right.
Richard, if you gave a full recap of this, this would have been an hour and 45 minute show. There's no way you could do a succinct recap of this.
Because there's a lot of subplots, yeah.
Oh, because this is three films. This is a trilogy jammed into one film because Warner Brothers is so afraid of letting what's working on television seep into their horrible movie house, which makes no sense to me. I blame all of this on Warner Brothers, not knowing what to do with these properties.
But that gets us more into comic book geek territory between you and I, because I do think that the true place for comic books is actually TV series,
mm-hmm,
because they are episodic in story nature,
mm-hmm,
and they are meant to be a serial.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So for me, it's sort of like watching Daredevil on the flip side is like, for me, that's my vigilante. You know, mm-hmm, when I was reading as a teenager, I was reading Bendis's Daredevil. That was my vigilante, my angry Catholic Irish vigilante.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, I don't know. So for this movie, I flipped my brain off because I knew if I just sat there, wasn't going to satisfy my nerd stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't going to satisfy my movie guy. So it's not going to satisfy either of them. So I'm just going to flip off and say, I watched this. I know what to expect in the future if they continue with Zack Snyder. Now, I will say there is a glimmer of hope that you have seen this happen in a lot of movies where they say Zack Snyder wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. You should replace him. And then they do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Ben Affleck is a big enough name that if he kind of sees a lot of this, he could.
And so he's a much better director.
And I don't think that DC, I don't think that the DC universe is thrown away yet. That's all I'm saying. But I am saying that the only way you can enjoy this movie is if you completely turn your brain off, like I did.
That's fair. And that's probably the nicest thing you can say about it.
I'm just going to say, I mean, there are parts in there that, like, see, that's a problem. It's not really a movie. It's a series of, you call them subplots, but it's a bunch of, like, other films jammed into this giant film that in the third act come together somehow, that there's really good little like 8-minute films in there. It's just that they're in this big mass of a trilogy jammed into one movie.
Right, right, right.
I think it's the greatest hits of superhero
it is,
comic that, oh. books. It's not,
yes,
it's not a good movie. It's oh, that was a great movie. Yep. That was a great moment from the comics and it was in there. So yeah, yep. It does percolate those little comic nerd feelings.
See, I couldn't even appreciate like, oh, they're gonna do Doomsday because it's so bolted on at the very end with no support and no history that the comics had already set up for that character. So when you build up to like what's essentially what the comic is called the death of Superman, so when you go into that, it has no emotional weight. And you know, I harp on this a lot when I talk about movies in general, but it doesn't matter if you're making the biggest sci-fi space opera, blow 'em up, crazy winged angel with tentacles thing, like the most non-human thing in the world. If you don't ground that tentacled winged angel in some sort of emotional reality, it doesn't matter. And to me, this movie, like a lot of Zack Snyder movies, just played like an extended music video.
Mm-hmm. I would say I'm going to make an argument. It plays like an extended video game.
Parts of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. But
anything with the Batman fighting anything. I'm telling you, all of his gadgets, everything you've seen, the look, all of that stuff comes straight out of Arkham Asylum, the video game, the very popular Rocksteady video game series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like when he threw all those little like red dot things that went on the gun and turned them off so they couldn't fire. That was straight from the video game.
Yeah.
So there was a weird, I noticed what I was seeing throughout the whole movie. I could pick it apart, but at some point I just have to be like, okay, let's hope there is some good stuff happening here that could be pulled apart for other movies. And that's all I want from it. Is it a good movie? It's serviceable. At best.
I say less than serviceable. I think it's sort of an affront to cinema, but I'll hold out a little hope. I'm not going to say I'm done with the DCU forever. As far as done, I mean, I'm going to have to see these movies to review them, but done as in having any kind of positive expectations until I see what David Ayer does with Suicide Squad, because he's a different director. He makes different kinds of movies. And Suicide Squad is just as bad of an idea to start off a movie universe with.
Yep.
So I want to see how he pulls it off and maybe in what kind of tones are going to shift in this DCU. If that movie's as much of a mess as this one is, which that's going to be hard to top, then I think I don't have a lot of faith in Warner Brothers with what they're doing with these properties.
I think I think you did a good highlighting moment right there, like honestly, because Zack Snyder is not a storyteller.
Nope.
If he came in for just Justice League, I think it could have worked, honestly. Yep. I don't think he knows how to set up a story or tell a story. He's much more into stylistics. He's much more into
surface.
Look. Yeah. Kind of surface stuff, but also kind of like he only wants to give you a blip of the emotional information before he goes into other stuff flipping and twirling around. I don't actually think he's a hack. I just don't think he's a very good storyteller as a filmmaker. He is much more interested in the visuals.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about David Ayer, I think does know how to tell a story. So I think that there is a possibility of seeing something kind of coming around to a better, DCU. Also, I've always been a Marvel guy. plus Batman. So I have a hard time. I have a hard time just being like, okay, DC Universe, fuck off. Yeah. I love Batman, so I'm going to give it a shot. I did like Ben Affleck. I did. And I liked his portrayal and where that could lead.
I thought they looked bored. I thought everybody in this movie not only looked miserable, but looked visibly bored, with the exception of Jesse Eisenberg, who's insanely miscast. I kind of appreciated that he was trying to do something with it and having fun with it, like at the expense of the audience, but he's still trying to eat the scenery up as much as possible because nobody else was.
Well, okay, I thought that was just them modernizing Lex Luthor instead of being the...
I kind of like the modern... Well, I think Denny O'Neill was a writer for a long time. He said that if you look at the history of Lex Luthor, he always reflects the times, whatever is the prominent power of the time. So it's going to be, you know, I mean, it was Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Right, yeah, essentially.
It would have been, ironically enough, Donald Trump, if it came out, you know, 30 years ago, the corporate tycoon. Well, he could have been it again. That's a fascinating film. It would just be like, with no reason whatsoever, he just runs for president. I don't want to go back to this, but like, how can Henry Cavill not look bored when he's the most powerful being in this film, yet he's getting the shit beat out of him the entire time, and he can never be Superman? He's getting pictures of his mother thrown at him, being tortured. He can never fully use his power. Half the world hates him. I mean, that's just not Superman. Of course he looked bored. The only thing he can portray on film is looking morose. Superman just looks morose for 45 minutes. Batman's supposed to be morose.
Yeah, I think it's just the tone.
Yes.
Like, I don't think it's actually the actors or the story they're telling. It's the same thing. We talked about this a while, Cassidy, about that YouTube video where they color corrected the Man of Steel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when I was watching, I was like, oh, this is better. And then I'm like,
oh, it's great. I love it. Yeah.
It's not better. It's just they changed the coloring because.
Oh, and my childlike mind, it was better just because there was more primary colors and everything wasn't gray. It was better.
Well,
it really was. It looked better.
It's one of those choices that people take for granted when they go see movies, but it is something that affects the overall way you feel about a movie. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I will say I struggled to find anything in this movie that I really liked, but the stuff that I thought the movie within these five different movies it's trying to do that I thought was the most acceptable was the kind of semi-sequel to Man of Steel where they carried on the political implications of there being a Superman. I kind of liked like seeing Nancy Grace and Neil deGrasse Tyson philosophically argue about Superman on TV in the background and that kind of stuff. And I could see that maybe there was a Man of Steel sequel that was written that was kind of repurposed or parts of it were kind of stripped to put into this movie. And I kind of wish I could go back and see that movie because I didn't hate Man of Steel. I didn't
the
like
Grant Morrison-esque like philosophy, superhero philosophy was actually kind of a cool part, but it was just background.
But you said, Richard, I mean, that was another part directly pulled from a writer, from a source. I mean, there's a line directly from Frank Miller's Dark Knight Strikes Back where he's got the gun on the mutant character in the comic, and he's got the gun on the guy with the flamethrower, and the guy says, "I'll do it." I mean, it's line for line, shot for shot, exactly lines up with the panels in it. The Neil deGrasse Tyson thing is right from, as you said, Grant Morrison's All-Star Superman. Those are all great, like four or five panels, which equate to in film 30 seconds of film, but that does not make a good film. It's just the greatest hits.
It's just minor detail, yeah.
Exactly, it's minutiae. It's making film out of minutiae, and it's impossible to do.
What were you saying, Cassidy? I didn't try to steamline you, but
I did. I'm sorry.
You're fine. I don't think I. I pretty much got all that. Oh, I just said I was going to say like you know I'm not a Zack Snyder supporter generally speaking. Some films I like more than others. I think. Like you mentioned, Richard, he's just not a good storyteller. So the less story-driven his movies are, the better they usually end up being. I did like a lot of Man of Steel until I stopped liking it towards the end.
Right.
But I thought that that was the closest he ever got to good emotional storytelling with, like, the stuff with his Kevin Costner as his dad. And even then, there's one scene in this movie where Kevin Costner appears again in some sort of vision, and it even sort of kind of for a second works. I can't really defend this movie on.
Well, he never goes off does Superman stuff after that. I mean, that's a rallying point in your film, the midway point where he's supposed to go off, and he never does. He just goes and I'm shouting. I'm sorry. He goes and self doubts himself some more for another hour in the film. That's the part I was like, all right, great. Here's the rallying cry moment. We're gonna reach a climax in a minute. He's like, nope, never happens. Because it's just another good scene. It was like, oh, that's a good scene. We'll put that here. There's no structure to the film.
I think producers need to learn how to use Zack Snyder. Zack Snyder is not a great storyteller.
Right.
He's a great visual artist. And I think that there's a place in moviedom for his type of filmmaker, but they don't know where to plug him in. And I think that because of how he did fairly well at the start of his career, they said, oh, he's this guy. They just don't understand that he's not that guy. He's this guy. That's kind of a vague way to say that, but it really is using his talents to a specific end.
Right. Not doing if you were going to reboot the Mortal Kombat series, Zack Snyder would be your guy.
Yeah, good call.
Or if you were going to, I don't know, do something of less consequence than even that, like
Mario Kart.
Sure, Mario Kart the movie. Zack Snyder's your guy. But
I think with that too, you need to make sure that he's not. They need a strong writer behind him.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking,
and I think actually this movie did have a strong writer. I think it was Chris Terrio.
It's written by committee. A lot of this I can't even 100% blame on Zack Snyder. I think like his problems are not helping the situation.
What's my complaint? Warner Brothers.
I think it's much more a studio problem than anything else.
Not understanding their characters. No, I thought that was good.
And adding way too much and piling on. To me, this reminded me a lot of the mess that was Amazing Spider-Man 2. Yep. And the worst aspects of Age of Ultron, but that now looks like Citizen Kane in comparison.
Yep. See? Would have helped if I sat next to you next time. If I go out to Salt Lake City or California, wherever you are, I'll buy a ticket and I'll sit next to you and I'll either annotate everything that's happening or I'll just lean next to you like I lean next to the girlfriend Melanie and said, I'll explain it in the car ride home. would that have helped things more?
Maybe. Maybe at least would have helped.
If I mansplained it.
That bizarre dream sequence. I was just so done. I was so done by that point. I was like, okay, now it's Sucker Punch. I don't care.
Lois Lane, it's too early, Cassidy.
You're not wrong about the Sucker Punch. That was one of my first... as soon as the dream sequence started, I was like, oh, this is straight out of Sucker Punch. Okay.
All right. Let's get into the Netflix homework. And like I said, you assigned this to me last week, Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you explain a little bit of what the movie Shelter is about?
Shelter is set in contemporary New York City. And you are introduced to two characters, and I'm not remember anyone's name. I'll say everyone by actor's name.
That's fine.
Anthony Mackie and Jennifer Connelly. And Jennifer Connelly is hustling on the street and clearly looks emaciated, is panhandling. And Anthony Mackie is meeting with his imam, and it's clear that he is, well, I think he spells out he's from Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And we get introduced in the first act to these characters a little bit, and he prevents her from committing suicide. And then they form a bond where it develops into a romantic relationship. And she vows to kick heroin for him. And there's more revealed about, and I don't want to spoil it because I think it's a pretty good reveal near the end, more about their lives. And it wraps up into a crescendo of trying to reconnect Jennifer Connelly with her past life and Anthony Mackie trying to find absolution for things he did in the past. And it is directed and written by Paul Bettany. Talking about superhero stuff. I mean, these are all superhero actors. Everyone is now.
Yeah.
But he's the Vision, and this is his first written and directed work, and Jennifer Connelly is his wife.
In real life?
I think it's in real life, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, yeah, that was information to both of us. Good.
I guess I'll start with Richard since you summed it up. What did you think of Shelter?
This is where personal biases come into play.
Go for it.
I'm a fantasist. When I go into a movie, I need my issues buried under deep levels of orcs and other weird shit or spacemen or whatever. Specifically with Shelter, I don't know. I prefer to, if it's about the homeless and the homeless situation, just give it to me in dry facts in a paper.
Or a documentary.
Or a documentary, maybe. It depends on what type of documentary. I tend not to gravitate towards one that make you so angry you want to burn down a building. That's just for personal, you know, problems.
Right.
But with this specifically, they live in such a dark world that I know exists for some people. But then you have this weird level of not truth moviness.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of takes away from the believability. It's weird because then you start kind of like, for me at least, the way that I guess reject sadness or anger or any of those things is through humor. So I started to make jokes in my head throughout halfway through the film, and then I'm like, oh, but this is a real this is about a real topic.
Right.
And so I start feeling guilty because a movie's talking about real stuff. Mm. I don't know. I mean, I get that it's kind of trying to go into that like Bicycle Thief kind of area. I don't think it pulls it off. I think that it kind of comes off as movie version of real issues as opposed to real world, like actually kind of getting down to the skin and bones. It's rich people interpreting poor people.
Mm-hmm.
That's I think you're actually doing your review a disservice by posting a caveat that generally you're more into fantastical topics, because I think a movie of this topic, like The Bicycle Thieves or like any number of Italian neorealist films or the films that they inspired. I also thought a lot about Panic at Needle Park.
Sure.
The movie that the Pacino movie we reviewed a long time ago in the Netflix homework. And a lot of the films from the 70s that kind of come from that era. I think that this movie aspires to be that, but you're absolutely right in that the rich people trying to interpret poor people's world. And there's, you know, I think for a first feature, is this Paul Bettany's first feature before I say that? Okay. I think for a first feature, it's not that bad. It's sufficient, but it really comes off as an actor's vision, because this movie is so actor dependent and actor focused on the way they decide to tell the story.
And I think both Anthony Mackie and Jennifer Connelly,
you know, they're good and they're game. I think the problem that I found with the movie is it's so dour and it's so depressing and it never lets up. And it's at a point it reaches a critical mass on how sad a movie can be before it just becomes ridiculous. I think the movie Precious mm-hmm. kind of runs into this.
Precious does it a little better, though. Because I'll say Precious gets a little, it does get kind of mean and gritty.
Yeah.
But there were moments that were supposed to have great gravitas that I kind of ended up rolling my eyes at. And it sounds bad, but I just did. It didn't do it for me.
Right. I don't want to like tear down the movie completely saying it's complete garbage, because I don't think it was.
No,
but I think that a lot of it does come off as pretty melodramatic. What about you, Patrick?
Oh, it's funny you were talking about an actor's film and it's geared towards the actors. I did not care anything what the plot was at some point. I just liked watching Anthony Mackie and Jennifer Connelly emote. And act. I mean, like, everything else was like, it was so character driven. It was so character involved. I forgot for the longest time. I was like, oh yeah, there's this, you know, going on where they have to find, like, I didn't quite understand the concept of the shelters. I mean, it's never really explained why they lose spots. And then they try to, at some point, you know, talk about the, medical issues in this country. And how, you know, hospitals are run incorrectly, and there's even a bit of immigration that they try to touch on at some point.
Right.
But like all that stuff was background noise that I really love Jennifer Connelly. I think she's one of the better actors of this generation. And I think she was great in this. And I forget how good she is until I see her in supporting stuff. So I was just happy to see her in a lead role. That's what really drew me to it in general. And then Anthony Mackie, who I knew from like We Are Marshall and the Avengers films, he's the Falcon. I did have an issue with, I always have an issue with American actors. Well, I'm just glad it was American actors the first time, but other actors, I'm sure there's a really good Nigerian actor out there who could have been a Nigerian. Anthony Mackie's not, which I always have a little problem. And, but he's great in it. And then there's a bit of, I think it's called Magical Black Man syndrome, whatever it is.
Yeah, there's a, I'd say a little bit more than a bit. Yeah.
Because there's, no, I mean, he has no faults. I mean, he is a super Mary Sue. That his issue is he cares too much. And that's what ultimately is his downfall. And he's going to help this white woman become, better at the end.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, oh, I roll my eyes at that, but it doesn't take away from his performance is great. And so again, like that stuff, I just go, oh, that's what this is. You know, first time director. He's going to lay the saccharine on pretty heavy here, but I just liked watching them act.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it ended, I didn't care if anyone lived or died or if they reset the entire thing. I was just like, well, that was a really good actor study. And that's how, what my big takeaway from it was.
Yeah. And I think that's generally what the goal of the movie was to be. I will say that there's some character reveals with both of them, but particularly Anthony Mackie, that I think saves him from just being the magical black man.
Mm-hmm.
And saves him from being, you know, so redeemable that it becomes silly. It comes a little too late, and it's maybe a little overkill. It's kind of overcorrects as far as that goes.
It is, but I wonder if that was explored more with him struggling with religion and that revelation. Would have been an interesting film all in itself.
Yeah, it might have. Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like I was like, oh, this is really interesting, but we don't have enough movie to explore any of this, so
right,
we're not going to get there.
I actually the docudrama stuff that you're talking about, sort of the other political issues that are kind of running underneath all of this going on. That's some of the stuff that I found a little bit more interesting. I like it when movies tell me how something that I don't normally know functions. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, the ideas of like. Because I've never been homeless. I've never been, like, out there, like, trying to survive on the streets. But I always wonder, you know, you pass people like that all the time. And you wonder, like, how do they not just, like, die of heat or starvation? Or, like how do they manage to make it work? And then you see, like, oh, okay, so there are these shelters around that allow them to stay for a day or two. Or they have to move from this thing to that thing. And I will say that, you know, I did come away with the movie with a little bit more empathy than I came in with.
See, I knew all this. I didn't feel like it taught me anything. Maybe.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is the only thing that I didn't see come into it is also, I guess technically it did because of her addiction, but mental health, how it comes into the homeless. And a lot of this stuff, I'm like, yeah, I know horrible things happen, you know,
well,
to the homeless. They're one of the most preyed upon people on the planet. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, sometimes that's. Either homeless people preying on other homeless people or people who are not homeless.
Right.
Using their shelter as a means for that. So,
I, again,
the issues brought up are all poignant and are great and need to be addressed. I just don't feel like this film really did it because, like you said, it just kind of goes into, oh, actors.
Yeah.
Right.
So for me, it's just like, okay, I guess. So I would rather watch something that gives me, you know, maybe I shouldn't just say fantasist because I'm not a romanticist necessarily. But what I am saying is that I want a kind of going back to, I guess, Superman, Batman kind of. I need emotional truth.
Mm. Right.
And I don't feel like this film.
This movie
gives
aspires
that to
it. It is, yes. and it really, really tries for it. And, you know, there's the, you know, if we are comparing the two films, which is totally bizarre to do, but Batman versus Superman doesn't even try, whereas this movie reaches way too far and you lose it because you can see it's reaching.
Mm-hmm.
That's well said.
It's a balancing act to make something feel real. Also, as far as like, you know, you're talking about the average homeless person's experience, these two cases in this movie, you know, these two characters would be very unrepresentational of the general homeless population. I mean, she comes from wealth and she knows French and she can kind of get by. And she's obviously, even though she's emaciated and whatever, she's still fairly attractive. She's still Jennifer Connelly. And same with Anthony Mackie. He's perfectly healthy and he's, you know, pretty learned and knows how to get by and pretty clever on his own. Though that's not generally always the case with a lot of the homeless who do have bigger disabilities.
Well, I forgot what the breakdown was, but in one of my classes, we did like a month where we just talked about like and looked at different studies and all that kind of stuff on like the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like something like upwards to like 80-90% have like severe mental health issues.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, even if you take away like addicts and all of that, I think it only still drops down to it's still like 70-60% because most of them are like severe, schizophrenics or severe manic depressives. And then you can get all this tie back into the economy and how in the 1970s they decided that, you know, people are just weird and sometimes you just have to let them be and you throw them out into society and then they can't take care of themselves. And it's not Jack Nicholson being zapped in a, even though that's a great fucking movie and has some emotional, see, that's a great movie, but it also, it sells you a, it sold America on a not great lie. There are people who really suffer and who really do need help. And Shelter, talking about this actual film, I feel like it pokes at it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was just absorbing what Richard said. I agree with all of it. The only other thing, the last thing I'll take away is both films are completely different. But again, we said about emotional impact. There's no moments of levity in either one of them. With Shelter, I mean, obviously someone making a joke at one point, like a Dirty Needle joke would be pretty weird that we all laugh at or something.
Yeah.
But there's not a moment of there's really minor victories where things look up. So, but it, with the big spectacle that it was, Dawn of Justice, no one makes a joke in that either, and it feels just as brutal to watch all of it play out. Where, you know, it's a human drama in one, the other one it's a science fiction spectacle, but there's no moments of levity in either one. That was my big takeaway that connected the two of them.
Yeah, they both are a little too self-serious. And there's something about Shelter, the way that a lot of scenes play out, like going back to the actor thing, where it feels a little stagey.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of the sequences of conversation set pieces when they're like in this like chateau or this apartment that they kind of break into and are allowed to live in for about a week. That feel very like they belong on a stage. Like, mm-hmm. I should be watching this as a play, not a movie.
And that could be just a whole movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And that could bring up all these issues at the same time. Well, like, he's getting over his cold because they came into a real house that, you know, that isn't being used. There's all sorts of things. Anyway, sorry.
No, but I thought that's where the movie was going to go. That the shelter was going to be this house they broke into, but then there was actual real shelters after that. Which then, again, that's where I gave up on the plot of the film. I was like, okay, I'm not going to follow the plot anymore. I'm following the characters.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that does the show. Patrick, thank you for coming on.
Oh, I like I said before, we're in warm up. I was super geeked to do this, so thank you so much for having me on.
Well, we're super excited to have you. Okay. We like a little Patrick time.
That's good.
And I have to read off a bunch of crap that I always do at the end of the show, but why don't you tell people where can they find your stuff? Where do they find your podcasts?
Well, the easiest way to do it is there's this thing called the internet, and there's these things called search engines like Google. Just punch in Make Dad Read Comics or Almost Educational, and it'll pop up on some kind of podcatcher or some kind of website that I haven't developed halfway through, and you're looking and say, oh, there's only one episode listed. Well, that's because I haven't finished the website yet. But either one, iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you find it on, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. I'm on both those all the time with my dad on Make Dad Read Comics and my co-host Dennis on Almost Educational.
Mm-hmm. And you got your Google game down as far as that goes.
I did.
You're easy to search.
Thank you.
And if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about in this show, send us an email over at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. Patrick was on the show, so he can't email us about it. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Follow us on Twitter @jabberpodcast. Do you want to plug your Twitters?
Oh yeah. It's Almost Educate for Almost Educational, and it's Make Dad Read.
There you go. I follow both of them. And
I don't tweet or Twitter. I know. Barely Facebook. So
at some point, I'm going to give Richard our Twitter codes and make him do it every once in a while.
Oh, Dennis is supposed to do our Facebook group, so they noticed I didn't plug that.
And yeah, we're on iTunes and Stitcher, and our regular archives are at jabberandthedrone@podbean.com. And we're on the Zune and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast and Player.fm. We're as many places as you can try and find us. I have reviews at saladforkreview.blogspot.com. I have a couple new things over at the MacGuffin, the Seattle-based website I write for, called MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy. And besides Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics, which I wholly recommend listening to, we also like to plug our other friends out there, like Rod and Denise, who you've also recorded with, mm-hmm. over at their podcast, The Listening Party. Our friend Leland, who's been on the show a few times, his comedy podcast that he does from his parents' basement in Olympia, Washington, dampercast.com. Check out friend of the show, Brad Decker's new lit zine blog at medium.com/panel-frame. And I think that's it.
That was good copy.
Talk to you later.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.